let me take you to the edge of a lagoon in Uwellen, a coastal village in Chukotka. Chukotka is the most northeasterly province in Russia, the one that nearly touches Alaska. The year was 2000. Sue Steinecker was walking along the edge of this Russian lagoon when she happened upon a young girl.
I mean, I was on a walk, and she was on a walk, and I just stopped and talked with her. I mean, it was just a random encounter.
Пожалуйста.
Петь?
Да.
Ну, хорошо. Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly.
It turned out that the girl was studying English in school. Sue was there to collect interviews, but sometimes she ended up recording moments that were a little more serendipitous, like this one. I wanted to start with this song for two reasons. First, this is a radio series on relationships between Alaskans and Russians in Chukotka. These two regions were separated by the so-called Ice Curtain during the Cold War. I spoke to people who worked, or are still working, to reconnect the two sides in a whole variety of ways. But a lot of them shared similar sentiments about how alike Russians and Alaskans are. In the end, we're all just people. You may think someone is so different from you, and then suddenly they start singing a Beatles song.
I don't know, she wouldn't say, I say.
The second reason the song is meaningful to the series is the lyrics. When the border finally opened in the 80s, it seemed like the ice curtain had permanently melted, like all troubles were far away. And yet,
now it looks as though they heed to stay.
My name is Lauren Frost, and this is Through the Ice Curtain, presented by Story 49.
Had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday.
Oh, beautiful! I can't clap! That's beautiful. Очень прекрасно.
We're going to go way back and start with something that happened 150 years ago this year, the purchase of Alaska from Russia. To walk us through the history, here's David Ramser, the author of a new book about the Ice Curtain.
Russia was primarily motivated by money. They had engaged in a war, the Crimean War, in the 1860s, and got their lunch handed to them, and they desperately needed money and decided to sell the colony of Alaska to the United States. And so they decided to unload it for $7.2 million, as most Alaskans know. And Alaska became part of the United States at that time. It was managed by the military and was pretty much out of mind from Washington, D.C. and from most Americans. Of course, there was a big flap over it being an icebox, Seward's Folly, a lot of the names that people assigned to the deal. But it turned out to be a pretty good one for the United States. Just a couple of hours of oil production today covers the purchase price, so the United States got a great deal out of it.
The purchase agreement said that Russians could stay in Alaska if they wanted. Most decided to leave. But Alaskans and Russians were still interacting in the Bering Strait region.
There were some isolated interactions across the border, mostly between Native people who continued to travel back and forth. They really didn't recognize the international boundary, and you had relatives living in what was then the Russian Far East and Alaska, and they would travel freely in boats back and forth to trade and hunt sea animals. There was historic visitation for hundreds, thousands of years, really, across the Bering Strait. And in 1938, the two governments, the Soviet Union and the United States, signed a formal agreement that allowed visitation between the native people of the two regions. It did not require people to have visas. They only had to check in. And there were certain requirements. They couldn't sell firearms or alcohol, so there were a few restrictions. But basically, it put into an agreement, which already had been practiced for thousands of years, that Native people could go across the Bering Strait to visit each other.
And yet, in 10 years, that long tradition of travel between the nations would come to an end.
Well, that agreement was signed in 1938, and then World War II broke out in 1940. And the United States and Russia actually had very good relationship across the Bering Strait in the name of the Lend-Lease program. And that's when more than 7,000 United States aircraft were flown up to Nome and then across the Bering Strait to help the Soviet Union in the war effort against Germany. So relationships between the two national governments were pretty good in the 40s during World War II. But after the war, starting in 1945, the Cold War started breaking out and the U.S. and Soviet Union got suspicious of each other. And so in 1948, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover closed the border with the concurrence of Soviet leader Joseph Stalin and said, nope, you can't cross the border anymore. That started in 48 and lasted for 40 years. And the impact was to isolate Native families on either side of the border. So you had immediate family members, brothers and sisters, and then more distant members who for 40 years were prohibited from seeing each other.
One region where this was true, the islands of Big and Little Diomede. They are split by less than 3 miles of water, and yet Little Diomede is part of the United States and Big Diomede is part of Russia. After the border was closed, the people of Diomede continued to try to visit their relatives on the opposite island, with disastrous results.
One time in the 40s, a number of Alaska Natives went over to Big Diomede for what they thought was a friendly visit with some distant relatives. They were captured and held in captivity for many weeks.
At the same time, propaganda and paranoia were making Alaskans and Russians even more distant from each other.
There was a lot of paranoia in Alaska about the Soviet Union in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And I remember as a kid in elementary school having these drills where we'd all have to dive under our desk in fear of atomic bombs coming from the Soviet Union. There were a lot of rumors about militarization on the Soviet side, the types of bases that they were erecting over there. And the United States did the same thing with the Dew Line listening posts. And so there were a lot of paranoia about each other across the border. There were what now seem like crazy programs where the FBI empowered certain Alaska citizens to have access to caches of food and radios so that if the Soviet Union invaded Alaska, they could inform Washington, D.C. about the invasion and where Soviet soldiers are. We kind of laugh at that now, but it's an indication of the rampant paranoia at the time.
For 40 years, the two nations lived in isolation, and families remained fractioned. Then, in the 80s, the ice curtains started to melt.
Yeah, I would say there are three main reasons for the improvement of relations between the Soviet Union and Alaska, and really starting in the mid-1980s. First, the memories of Native families across the border were starting to fade. These were people who had last seen relatives 40 and sometimes 50 years ago. And so these people were very old, and they wanted one last opportunity to see their long-lost relatives on the Russian side. Two, you had Gorbachev come to power in Russia, and he was interested in improving relationships with the West. And then three, Alaska business and cultural and civic leaders sort of detected an opportunity for improved relations across the strait. And so I think for those three primary reasons, the border started to open up. And you had a number of people in Alaska, largely centered in Nome, who undertook a number of initiatives. One of the more famous and funny is from Jim Stemfel, a Nome realtor, who undertook what I like to call balloon diplomacy.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. This is Jim Stemfel, Nome, Alaska.
Jim Stemfel came to Nome from Fairbanks in 1981.
And then was in the real estate business, and the real estate market started to crash in about 1985. We went through an auto recession where I stopped selling houses. Meanwhile, I had married a person from the King Island community, Bernadette Alvana.
From his wife and from others in Nome, Jim heard stories of families separated by the border.
And that intrigued my interest as to how that happened, and people still were related to each other by marriage or blood. And so I got interested in that.
He also heard about the historical travel between the two sides.
I thought, wow, that sounds like it could happen maybe again. So I got some balloons, which were weather balloons from the Weather Service, and I didn't have enough helium, so I blew one up with carbon monoxide from the car exhaust. Thinking that the hot air would make it rise. And from there we attached a little paper bag load of trading items like sugar, tea, sewing needles, things like that, and a few messages written in English and Inupiat, and actually Russian, because there was a person in Nome that could speak Russian. Anyway, the balloons got, we went down to the port area. The wind was blowing across the Bering Sea toward Russia, or the Soviet Union at the time. And we launched a few balloons, and they went up and then came back down again. And I watched with a pair of binoculars as the balloon was coming back down. A boat came up to it, and that boat grabbed the balloon, put it on their boat, and then drove down the coast. I followed in my car down the coast, and then the boat landed just before Cape Nome. And the group that got out of the boat was Tim Galagergan and some of his hunters. They were out hunting seals or walrus, and they came out of the boat and they recognized me and said, "Hey, Jim, guess what? We found this balloon coming across the Bering Strait and it has some message written in Russian." And I said, "Oh, no, Tim, I sent that balloon over."
After his short-lived stint as a balloon diplomat, Jim got more involved with trying to reconnect families. He got to know the mayor of Providenia, and he helped people on Diomede get their passports. Plus, Jim wasn't the only person taking the initiative. Here's David.
Down in Juneau, there was a woman named Dixie Belcher, who was sort of a peacenik and a musician.
My name is Dixie Belcher, and I have been a peace and environmental activist.
Dixie was in a folk rock group in the 60s that toured all over Alaska.
And I found out that you could affect change, social and political change with music, and you could do it actually fairly rapidly.
She carried that lesson with her. In February of 1985, a woman was trying to get Dixie to join a peace organization. She mentioned something about taking Alaskans to Siberia, and suddenly, Dixie had a new project.
And I had a full-blown idea of taking people across the Soviet Union and trying to open the border. It just popped out of my head that let's see if we can use music and dance and stuff and see if we can't, you know, lead a movement to open that border.
Dixie assembled a group of performers, one that she hoped would reflect the diversity of Alaska. It included Yupik elders, gospel singers, a jazz band.
We eventually all came together, these individual performing groups, at Kings Lake Camp outside of Anchorage, and in 5 days put a show together. I'll tell you about our very first performance. I had gone to Russia twice before then, and whenever I could, I went to a performance, any kind of a performance. You know, if the Russians know anything, they know how to perform. They, you know, if they're some of the best in the world. And I would go sit to this, you know, an incredible performance, and the whole audience would clap in time together, you know, clap, clap, clap. You know, all together, it was just like without any kind of enthusiasm or anything. And when we got there, UB40, which, you know, was this big Irish rock band, was just getting ready to perform in Leningrad. And it was the very first rock band from out of the country to do that. And they had 17,000 people in the audience, including our Yupik kids from Chivak. And, you know, they, you know, carry on like a rock band does up on stage. And then they'd finish, and the whole 17,000 people would clap, 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 you know, simultaneously. And I thought, we're done for. So before our first performance, an hour before, I brought everybody together, and I said, Russian audiences are very unenthusiastic, you know, and you're not going to get a lot of clapping or response. And that doesn't mean you're not doing a good job. It just means that's how they are. So when we started out, I had Chuna McIntyre, he's a Yupik from Eek, and an artist and a performer, and anyway, and he was in all of his furs and stuff on the stage by himself, and he would hit the drum, you know, over his head, and he would yell, Ugi Aman Agusa Aguse, which means, my people, I come to you. And villagers used to sing it when they would arrive to another village. And the drum actually became a symbol of peace, and it would, if a drum was sticking up out of the tundra, you knew it was a peaceful village. But he hit the drum, he would say that, and then on either side of kind of this auditorium place came elders, all head to toe in furs and with their drums over their heads and singing. And then behind them came these five black gospel singers on, you know, on either side, dressed in dashikis and stuff. And the white people in parkas behind that followed, you know, at the end with a clinket. And when we got to the stage, we switched languages. We switched into Russian. And we had a jazz band. And when we started to get up on the stage, everything had changed, and they were, you know, and it was Russian. And the entire audience stood up and started to clap with us over their heads. Well, this was the last thing anybody expected. And it was very emotional because these were our enemies. I mean, people were terrified to come. A lot of people were really terrified to come. But then we did music that I thought possibly the Russians knew. And one of the things I picked was We Shall Overcome. And what I didn't know is that they all at that time learned that song in English and when they were in school. And so people would come and literally break down doors to get in to see us. So it was always full of soldiers, you know, to keep kind of things under control. And when we would get to, this always happened, it seemed, when we got to We Shall Overcome, you would see sometimes thousands of people jump to their feet and hold hands over their heads and sing with us. And the soldiers would come flying down the aisles and in this one place that leapt up on the stage and put their arms around us and sing in their high tenors and basses and stuff and sing with us. It was a huge shock. A huge shock. I mean, it was the last thing we expected when that whole audience just got to their feet and started clapping their hands in time to the drum. I mean, I can't tell you how unexpected it was. It was just a shock. And of course, it made a lot of the performers just start sobbing. I mean, actually, I could hardly talk about it because it was very emotional.
There were emotional scenes off stage as well.
What happened on the first performance is that there was a school in Leningrad that was for the native peoples of the north.
Some of the students from this school were Siberian Yupik. They met up with the Yupik performers after the show.
And they started to speak to them in Siberian Yupik. And I was standing next to an elder who suddenly realized she was talking to her nephew and had no idea that she even had a nephew.
To this day, Dixie remembers the power of those performances.
And the whole audience was there with us. They were on their feet most of the time and singing with us. And at the end, singing and dancing with us. It was the enemy. I think that if people could have some idea and some experience of what we, in quotes, call the enemy, probably we wouldn't have enemies anymore.
David credits one more major event with improving Alaska-Soviet relations.
In 1987, you had a California endurance swimmer who had long been affected by the proximity of the two regions and the Cold War, and she decided to do this crazy thing and swim between the Diomede Islands.
The swimmer's name was Lynn Cox. In Nome, Jim Stimpfel got involved with the project.
Yeah, that was a kind of an interesting thing that happened was this young woman from California who was a cold water swimmer. She had swam different distances in cold water, and she wanted to come up to the Bering Straits to swim between Little Diomede and Big Diomede. So there was a team assembled here in Nome of people. We all kind of were helping her swim every day in the Bering Sea, and she just wore a bathing suit and would practice swim in the surf. And then as we got toward the date of going over to Little Diomede, the rest of her team arrived, including a doctor from London who was a cold water expert. And then the ABC Wild World of Sports people showed up, and we all got into planes, and then the helicopter flew us from Wales to Little Diomede, and there was about, I think there was about 17 of us in that group, some local people from Nome, and then her team of people. Finally, they got approval to do the swim, and Pat Omiak was the mayor of Little Diomede at the time, so it was agreed that only one boat could go with her as an escort. And I thought to myself, wow, well, this is a great opportunity for us to all go. So talked everybody into getting in their boats. So we had about 6 to 10 boats filled with men, women, and children all watching her jump in the water at Diomede and start swimming with nothing but a swimming suit on. She didn't put any bear grease on or any kind of grease. She just started swimming, and we all were in these boats behind her, and it was foggy that day, and so we couldn't really see Big Diomede, and we were just in the boats drinking coffee, you know, motoring along, talking by CB radio with each other. Pat Omiak was in the lead boat with the Dr. Keating from London, who was the cold weather expert, and Lynn Cox had swallowed a thermal probe into her stomach, so every once in a while she would do the backstroke, and Dr. Keating would stick a stick out with a a radio transmitter on it that would measure her core temperature to see if she was okay. So somewhere out there in the fog, the Soviets came out in a boat, and we saw them for the first time since 1948. And they were soldiers with guns and dressed in uniforms. And the lead Soviet guy put his arms up to make a motion to stop, you know, tell us to stop. And then Pat in his boat was motioned through, and the rest of us just sort of stayed right there watching them disappear into the fog toward Big Diomede. So we were just kind of wondering what to do, and Pat was on the CB radio, so we were listening to him talk, and so we told all the other boats, decided, well, let's head back to Little Diomede, but we were in the fog. We couldn't even see Little Diomede anymore, and I was in a boat with an older couple, and we started motoring back to Little Diomede, and suddenly this huge rock wall appeared in front of us, and Ruth and her husband were sitting there looking at it, and they looked up at the rock wall and said, oh no, this isn't Little Diomede, this is Big Diomede, we're gonna be arrested. We said, oh, no, no, we're not going to be arrested. So Moses Milligrock, Moses, told the boat driver, which was his son, to go ahead and CB radio back to Diomede to fire a rifle so we could hear a sound, you know, where Little Diomede was. But Moses and Ruth knew exactly where they were because of the rock wall, because they used to go over there to pick berries and greens. And so Moses points his hand into the fog and says, go that way. And I say to myself, we got no compass, we got nothing. And he just points his hand to go that way. So his son drives the boat in that direction, and we land at Little Diomede. But they knew that we were going around the north end of Big Diomede. They knew exactly where we were.
The movement to melt the ice curtain was gaining momentum, but the biggest event was yet to come.
So there were a lot of those incidents and many more that started this drumbeat of opening the border, which kind of culminated with the 1988 Alaska Airlines Friendship flight.
More next time on Story 49. Thank you so much to all who made this episode possible. Special thanks to Sue Steinecker, Jim Stimpfel, Dixie Belcher, and David Ramser. David's book, Melting the Ice Curtain, is available now in bookstores across Alaska. Music in this episode was by Mystery Mammal, Kevin McLeod, and Dimension Bucket. If you or someone you know has a story to share, contact KNOM at 443-5221. Or by email at story49@knom.org. Story 49, sharing your story, your voice, your Alaska.